bitch please.
Oh, bitch please my ass. You want a sandwich?
Dig that.
Oh, hell yeah.
She's a bad man, a gentleman. I'm a black man in a white world.
If I wasn't a Christian man, I'd probably be kicking in your ass.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the JB's Low Tech Podcast. Today's guest is more than just a used car salesman, and I'll prove it next. Here on the JB's Low Tech Podcast.
When you need someone to listen, a lawyer you know and trust.
Congratulations to all the Minnesota businesses that scraped through the last year. It sure hasn't been easy, but we've done it together. And while we certainly need to move forward, it's good to reflect on what we've been through and the many losses. Here at Bradshaw and Bryant, we held a lot of Zoom meetings, increased our phone calls, and have done our best to keep up with all the changes while continuing to provide quality work. We'd like to thank everyone that turned to us with their personal injury and criminal needs, as well as the courtrooms for bringing the community back together to serve justice. We look forward to being part of Minnesota's growth and success for many years to come. I'm Mike Bryant from Bradshaw and Bryant. I hope you're never injured in a collision, but if you are, don't sign anything till you've talked to us.
Find Bradshaw and Bryant, personal injury attorneys at MinnesotaPersonalInjury.com.
Seeking justice for the injured, Bradshaw and Bryant.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the JB's Low Tech Podcast. Today's guest, as I stated earlier, is more than a used car salesman. He's a youth minister, he's a music man, and he also has his own podcast. And he's big into radio. And this morning, he's getting his morning cup of coffee. ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to Doug Sprinthal. How you doing, Doug?
I'm doing fine, John. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well,
it's kind of fun to do it on a Saturday. It's a whole different feel, isn't it?
Right.
It's sort of relaxed, and that's great.
With the job that I have now, I get off at 6, and it's like, there's no way I can squeeze it in. Well, it'll be pretty tough to squeeze it in during the week, you know.
Yeah.
Trying to come down from the workday and everybody else. So I just figured, I'll do it on Saturdays. So how... I'm just going to start with this, and we'll end with talking about cars, too. How did you get into cars?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it was a long time ago, and nobody really gets into the car business on purpose. We all come to it accidentally. I was a liberal arts major. I had a degree in psychology. I was working as a mental health counselor in a locked psychiatric units in the late 70s and early 80s. And it was, and I was planning to go to graduate school, but it was about that time that the government got together with the insurance companies and cut mental health benefits down to just about nothing. So a lot of the psychiatric care facilities, state hospitals were forced to close. And it really is the start of the current homeless problem that we have in this country. A lot of it was triggered by what happened in the early 80s.
Yes.
I saw the writing on the wall. I thought I better get my butt into grad school. But the only problem was I didn't have any money. And a friend of mine was selling cars, and I always liked cars. I learned how to fix my own because I like to drive them, but, came from a family that just didn't have the luxury of a lot of money. So if you wanted to drive a car, you had to figure out how to make it run yourself. So I enjoyed that part of it. I thought, I'll do it for a little bit. But I was hesitant to get into business because, I grew up in the really came of age in the early 70s, and it was the end of the hippie era and question authority and all business is bad and business people are terrible. I mean, that kind of was the psychology of what the culture I grew up in. And what I realized after a couple of years, it's like, actually, business is really interesting because it's, to be good at business, you have to be a creative problem solver. And that's something that liberal arts students are really good at. I mean, you learn how to be creative and so on and so forth. So when I started looking at it as a series of problems to overcome and so on and so forth, my career took off, and I've been in it. So that's what, 38 years? Can that possibly be true? I guess it is.
Right. Well, you hit on an interesting note doing that origin story there. You talked about mental health causing the homeless issue that we have in this country. And
yeah.
I worked with homeless teens in the 1990s for about 5 years. And you're
yeah.
right. It is a very interesting, interesting world to venture into because not only are kids being tossed away or running away for safety, you got kids and adults out there who nobody knows what to do with, and the government cut away the one area that was helping them.
Yeah, and it's sad. Mental health has always been looked at. It's like the least understood of all the medical practices. And by lay people, it's really funny because they almost look at it like you have a character defect if you're depressed. If you suffer from severe depression, it's like, well, I just go on walks. Well, you know, walking is good for you regardless of your mental health, but it's not going to solve the problem. You don't say that to a friend of yours that is diagnosed with cancer. It's just like, you know, you had it coming, it's your own fault. Well, maybe
right.
they smoke tons of cigarettes, you could say that, but you get the point. But yep. mental health is somehow, it's thought to be completely under the person's control when really it isn't to a great extent.
Yeah.
I don't know. You got me on a soapbox. I never get to talk about this stuff, JB. This is cool, man.
Well, I allow my guests to kind of take the show where they want to go, but during the pandemic, had an episode myself where I, because of the, you know, the isolation that the pandemic caused, found myself basically totally alone. You know, there would
yeah.
be Zoom calls and whatnot. Now, I was lucky in a way. I was deemed essential in my job, so I had to get up and go to work every day and function, you know, get up, get clean, put clothes on, get out the door, get to work. But then I come home and it was basically fix dinner and watch TV. And that isolation, you know, I suffer from anxiety, and that isolation caught up with me. Cause it was,
yeah, no, I'm sure it was a challenge for a lot of people. And I have a fair number of single friends, and I think it was, you know, much harder for them by a magnitude of quite a bit.
Yeah.
Although I'll tell you a funny story.
Go ahead.
You know my wife, Sarah, and she works, she does communications for this big Catholic church in Hastings, which is her hometown. So she worked, they had them working from home
mm-hmm.
in the early days of the pandemic, maybe 6 weeks, and then they're calling them all back in because the church was big enough they could safely, everybody had their own office, they didn't interact, you know, face-to-face, but and she really enjoys her job. The problem was when she'd get home, I was like a two-year-old puppy. I just wanted to play. Come on. It's great to see you because I've been sitting around in my green room all day on Zoom calls, just bored
right.
out of my mind. And she's like, get the hell away from me. I need a little downtime. I'm like, damn it. So it was, we survived, and I'm
right.
glad you did too. But, you know, I think that the cool thing, the better thing about mental health today, and it's really because of, stuff in the media, talk shows certainly help. You know, even Dr. Phil, as much as it is fun to make fun of him, at least it's people, it's more acceptable to talk about these problems in the open. There's less shame than there was in years past. It's got a long way to go, but I think that because of that, those outlets, it's better. I mean, for you, to come on a podcast and say, you know, I really suffered from depression and anxiety and I was alone and the pandemic was hard. You know, dudes weren't really supposed to say that until fairly recently, right?
Right. Well, for me, one of the things that helped me, you know, I used to work full time in athletics and now I dabble in it, was seeing all the athletes who would come out and talk about, you know, their struggle. And, you know,
yeah,
here there are fit young people on top of the world. You know, tons of people know them. They get, you know, they're celebrities and they make a lot of money. And for them to talk about, you know, their struggles was really helped me.
Wasn't there a woman in the last week? I think she's on the USA women's Olympic basketball
yes.
team mm-hmm. who pulled out because she was having some issues.
Right. And people just don't understand a lot of the time what they do or what we do also causes major stress in our, you know, in our lives. And those, you have Naomi Osaka, who's a tennis, world famous tennis player, who has, who has pulled out of the last two majors because, you know, she's struggling with it. And now she's afraid that when she goes back, unfortunately, that's just going to be the focus of the interviews that she's going to be forced to have. So,
well, you know, and it probably will for a while, but all that stuff sort of passes. I mean, you know, the greatest golfer that ever played had just a whole host of personal issues.
Yeah.
And that was the topic of interviews for a while. But then, it went away. So that is the good thing. I think most sports fans tend to be fairly forgiving as a bunch for stuff like that, and it's good. But you're right. It will be, people will be asking her, you know, how do you feel? It's like, oh, boy, how annoying would that be?
Well, yeah. And then I think she is, I was on digging through Netflix last night, and there's a two-part show about her life growing up, so maybe that'll help also educate people and turn things for, you know, as far as people going there. So you're also a musician. What in the world, first of all, what do you play? What got you involved in music, and what are your favorite bands or groups?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. So my main instrument is guitar, but I can play piano, bass, played trumpet as a kid. I've been forcing myself to play drums, so my wife is just a really gifted singer. And we've done this a couple of times where we have a little recording studio at home and we'll make records for fun. And we usually bring in other people to play drums and stuff, but during COVID it's like, let's do it all ourselves. So I played all the instruments.
Mm-hmm.
We picked a bunch of songs that we always wanted to cover. Oddly enough, most of them were piano player songs, Elton John, Leon Russell, so on and so forth, and I'm just a passable piano player, so it was really hard, but it was a lot of fun. But the way I got into music, I come from a pretty musical family. I have a cousin, older cousin, who went to Berklee School of Music and got a degree. My uncle, my dad's older brother, scored for big bands in the late 40s, early 50s, and was a really good musician himself. A couple of cousins that played, and my grandmother, who lived in a little town called Pawtucket, Rhode Island. It's a little industrial town just sort of south of Providence. We would all get together, because I grew up in Massachusetts and my cousins lived in New England, and we'd get together on holidays, and the family would always have a jam session in my grandmother's front room, this old beat-up upright piano.
Mm-hmm.
And I was as a younger cousin, I was motivated to get good enough so I could play with my family. That's how I got started. And trumpet was my first instrument, followed by piano. Then I got braces and discovered girls and puberty, and I thought, I think the guitar might be a sexier instrument than a kid with braces playing trumpet. So that's how it started. And I played in bands off and on. I've never really made it, but I always enjoyed doing it. Bands are weird. It's, if you've never been in a band, you think, God, that's going to be the coolest thing in the world. And it's like having five girlfriends. That sounds like it would be cool, unless you actually had five girlfriends. And
right.
The ego and the drama, and it exists at every level. Fleetwood Mac kicked Lindsey Buckingham mm-hmm. out of Fleetwood Mac a couple of years ago. He's a great guitar player. He wrote a whole ton of their hit songs. They're all millionaires, and they're all probably either side of 70, and they're still doing band drama. It's so funny. And it happens at every level, from 16-year-olds in garage bands to you know, platinum selling multi-million dollar
right.
rock stars. So, and I think your last question was, who do I like? And I do like, you know, guitar player music, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Jeff Beck, so on and so forth, kind of all the classics. I still really dig that because I think they're great players. What I laugh at is people say, there are no great singers anymore. And Tom says this all the time. And I call him on it constantly.
Right.
And I said, you need to listen to this band. One of my favorites that I discovered 2 years ago is the Black Puma.
Right.
I think Eric Burdon's a terrific classic soul singer. And if you don't think those guys are good, you're not paying attention. My daughter, who is 2 years ago when she was 16, really wanted to see Lizzo. And Lizzo was playing at the Armory. And she was off my radar. I thought, okay, she's probably just some sort of a pop star that kids like. And then I saw an interview with her on 60 Minutes. I'm like, holy crap, this woman is really talented. So, you know, it's different than the classic rock era of the 70s when you'd have these huge, you know, rock concert shows. But to think that there aren't talented musicians out there playing and writing and stuff today, it's just foolish. It just tells me that people really aren't paying attention.
Well, and part of that is the, you know, my era is better than your era, and
that's certainly true. Yeah, no, and I think there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, you know, my dad likes the Beatles, but to him, it began, started, and ended in the big band era of the 40s and 50s. To him, that's the greatest music ever played. And the only issue today, and I think it is a good thing because, you know, back before digital recording studios and stuff, it was really expensive to make records. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if you were trying to make it, just to have the ability to record was really hard. Now anybody with a, you know, $500 laptop, a little studio, and some mics
right.
can make decent-sounding recordings. The problem is that they can make decent sounding recordings of really bad, poorly played music, right? I mean, right. There's no filter, so it's all out there. So Rudy Luther, who I worked for a while, had this is my take on modern music. He says, sometimes you have to wade through the shit to get to the strawberries. I think that's kind of what the current case is. I mean, there really is you go onto YouTube and just listen to mortifyingly bad music for as long as you want. But there's also, it gives people the ability to take more control over their music, you know, career if they're at that level and really control the process more, which I think is a good thing.
I'm really going to stretch your memory with this question. Can you remember the name of any of the bands you played in?
Oh, sure. I played in, it's funny, I played in for about 10 years in what would be now called a classic rock band called The Authorities.
Oh.
It was a weekend warrior bar gig deal, and the band is still together. It's been together for 30-some years. And the other guitar player, and he was the leader of the band, and I were driving to a gig somewhere, and it was up by Hinckley somewhere, so we kind of had a long time to chat. And we started talking about the music we're playing, and he goes, you know, we perfected rock and roll in 1974, and everything else since then has been derivative. Well, 10 years later, I'm watching The Simpsons, and Homer Simpson says almost exactly the same thing. I'm like, wow, you ripped off Greg Smith. So that was that was probably the band I was in the longest. I had a couple of bands in college. The Airedales, that was really a fun one. And then Sarah and I had played together in two or three different versions of the same band. But we play so rarely, or we did. You know, we'd play once a month, and it was always for fun. We'd play at, you know, the Tour de Tonka. We started the Walzer Wednesday stuff at the old Midway Stadium for the St. Paul Saints. So for the hell of it, we would just change the name of the band every time we played. So it was really never a long-standing one.
Okay.
My brush with rock fame actually is my long-lost stepbrother that I just reconnected with through a podcast, actually, in Facebook. Our parents were married in the 70s for about 15 minutes. Actually, it was probably about 3 years, but it went by pretty quickly. And he was 3 years younger than I am. I was already a sullen, skinny, pot-smoking, long-haired 15-year-old, and he thought I was, like, cooler than hell. And I taught him to play a few chords when he was 12, gave him maybe two or three lessons. Well, he was talking about this on the podcast that he was doing. It was a music podcast. And they said, you know, how'd you get started? And he goes, I had a stepbrother, and I thought he was really cool, and he taught me how to play, and it was really, you know, he'd loan me records all the time. I had no idea that I was that much of an influence on him. I think he would have been famous anyway, but his name's Dan Murphy, and Dan is the one of the two original members of Soul Asylum. So
wow.
It was really cool. It was cool to connect with him. We went out to dinner, had a great time. And I actually had him on Tom's podcast, and we started telling bar band stories from the 80s and, you know, what it was like to be in Soul Asylum and how they went from being terrible to great overnight. So that's my the closest I've ever been to being a famous rock star is influencing a 12-year-old kid who went on to become, you know, a pretty famous guy. So
all right, one of those stupid greater than question: the best guitar solo that you think that's ever been in music?
Oh man, you know, that will change all the time. And it's a natural thing to try to rank it.
Yeah.
I also think that there's a problem with making music a competitive sport. It certainly is at some level, but I, you know, for me, it really depends on my mood. I used to like, you know, technical wizardry. So, you know, Eddie Van Halen's Eruption, which really just blew that band wide open. It's the solo high-speed electric guitar introduction to You Really Got Me. I mean, when that came on the radio in 1977, I and a lot of musicians just lost their minds. It's just like, who in the hell is that? I'm a huge Hendrix fan. His last band was the Band of Gypsies, and they only recorded one album. It was live. It was New Year's Eve, I think, at Madison Square Garden. But he plays a song called Machine Gun, which is a protest song about the Vietnam War. Sorry, it's choking on coffee. It's stunning. I mean, you can feel there's so much emotion, and you can feel the anguish about, you know, this is a war that's killing, you know, young inner city people, and we shouldn't be there. It's just, it's really powerful. I'm a huge Jeff Beck fan. I was watching a live clip of him from a couple of years ago. He's playing with a guy named Jules Holland, who a lot of people in the U.S. don't know. He was the keyboard player in Squeeze, but he has this hugely popular music show in England called Later with Jules Holland, and the talent lineup is unbelievable. But it was Jeff Beck playing a Ray Charles song called Drown in My Own Tears, and it was just stunning. So I can't pick one, JB. I just
well, for me, there's two of them. One is rock bass and one is funk bass. It is in the song Knee Deep by Parliament Funkadelic, and their extended version, there is a 5-minute guitar solo. 5 minutes guitar solo. And go ahead.
I'll have to check that out. I have two P-Funk albums,
mm-hmm.
Motor Booty Affair, and I don't remember the other ones. And I have the actual records that I bought when they came out, but I'm not familiar with that one. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah,
George Clinton is he's a mad scientist.
Yes, he is.
I mean, how can you not like that guy?
Yeah, it's Knee Deep, and it's the extended version, because the extended version goes for almost 15 minutes. It goes past 15 minutes, and 5 of that is a guitar solo. And the other one is the guitar solo in Kid Charlemagne by Steely Dan.
Well, yeah, no, you don't have to. Those guys there's a great documentary called, I think it's a series called Classic Vinyl. You can find it on Amazon, I think. But they have, they interviewed Becker and Fagan. It's about the making of Asia. And then they interviewed all the different musicians that played on it. And it's really interesting how they work.
Yeah, I own that.
That's very sophisticated music. And just, you know, I have their greatest hits album. And if you look at the top flight musicians that played on those Steely Dan records, it's like, no wonder they sounded so good.
Yeah.
But I think that Kid Charlemagne, is that Larry Carlton that plays that one?
Yes,
I don't remember.
Yes, it is. It is Larry Carlton.
Okay.
I couldn't remember his name, but as soon as you said it, I was like, yeah, that's Larry Carlton. It's it has made him very, very famous, and it's tried and talked about by many musicians, guitar players, as the one to try to to master. So so if people, if you can look into those two, you'd be very happy, as they're very upbeat and they take you through a lot of twists and turns. Doug,
you know, I told you that Sarah and I make records. One of the ones we made a couple of years ago was called 1974, mm-hmm. and it was comprised of songs that were released in 74. And we did Any Major Dude by Steely Dan.
Oh, okay.
And that's one of my favorite Steely Dan songs because it's one of the few ones that's actually uplifting and positive.
Right.
Most of their songs are pretty dark, you know, killers and murderers and bad girlfriends and lecherous old men. And
well,
Any Major Dude is like, oh, this is kind of they must have been in a good mood when they wrote it.
Well, they are major storytellers. Donald Fagen, when he goes out on his, you know, he also has a solo career, and he has an album, Karma Curiat, and it's basically him driving on the road and the weather changes. That's what he's singing about.
Wow.
And the people he's meeting along the way and whatnot in the area. But it's a very, very good album, but very interesting.
You know, Sarah and I were talking about famous singers, and there's so many of them, like Donald Fagen, Mick Jagger, Leon Russell, you know, the list goes on and on. They're terrible singers, absolutely horrible.
Yes.
They wouldn't even make it into the starter version of The Voice. They wouldn't make it past the entrance stand, but you can't imagine anybody else singing those songs.
Right.
The Rolling Stones wouldn't be the Rolling Stones without, you know, mushmouth Mick Jagger kind of slurring his way through stuff. And Donald Fagen, I mean, it just sounds like a 13-year-old boy going through puberty. But you couldn't imagine those songs sung by anybody else.
Well, I learned something about a month ago that shocked the crap out of me. A few years, you know, as I was doing KQ morning show, I had learned that the Isley Brothers actually started out as a rock group, sort of.
Yeah.
And one of the people that played for them was Jimi Hendrix. But I never knew that part until there's this thing going on the internet during the pandemic where R&B and soul artists would kind of have a face-off, and it was called Versus. And they would also interview them, and the Isley Brothers talked about hiring Jimi Hendrix. I was like, what?
Yeah, I think that I might get this wrong, but I think Ernie Isley, who was the guitar player in the Isley Brothers, was hugely influenced by Hendrix. And he will, you know, his famous solo is, what's the song? Who's That Lady?
Yes.
He attributes that to his Hendrix influences, and it doesn't sound like Jimmy, but you know, it's interesting to me that all these super talented people seem to find each other. It shouldn't happen. I mean, the odds are, you know, Muscle Shoals, Alabama is a town of 5,000 people and winds up being the home of one of the greatest jobbing rhythm sections of all the time, the Swampers. I mean, and sadly, most of them have passed away, but you know, they played with Wilson Pickett, they played with Aretha Franklin tunes. It's a tiny little town in the middle of nowhere. So, and that's the same thing that Jimi Hendrix, probably my favorite, not probably, he is my favorite rock guitar player of all time. Everybody, you know, there's Jimi Hendrix and there's everybody else. He would happen to, you know, he played for Little Richard, too. He was in his backup band.
Oh, I did not know that.
Super famous people, yeah. Yeah, he was just a rhythm guitar player, and it would have been kind of fun if Little Richard had let Jimmy cut loose, because they're pretty flamboyant people. I'm a big Little Richard fan. I think people overlook his and Jerry Lee Lewis's contribution to really kick-ass rock and roll. I mean, those two guys were just badass in their day, and they still are. They're old men, but
right.
Anyway, but it's funny how talent seems to find each other.
Well, and you had mentioned that solo by Ernie Isley and Who's That Lady. That was a pretty psychedelic guitar solo at that time. They called it psychedelic music. and it was a pretty psychedelic song. So
I know you're a fan of that stuff. Have you watched this documentary called Summer Soul?
No, I have not.
Oh, dude, you can thank me later.
Okay.
So in 1969, it's like a Harlem, New York community awareness concert. It's 3 days long. And they filmed the whole thing, and it was never released.
Wow.
So Questlove, who's the drummer in, is it Jimmy Kimmel's band? I always get the late night guys screwed up.
Yes.
He directed the thing, and it's just wonderful. So you've got, and I can't remember the people that did, dang it. This is what happens when you don't, oh, Happy Days, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
A young Gladys Knight and the Pips. Gladys is like, she looks like she's 15, chubby cheeks, white school girl socks and these tiny little heels. Stevie Wonder doing a 10-minute drum solo. Sly and the Family Stone. Nina Simone. You will I've been trying to get Tom to watch this because it's right up his alley. You will totally love this documentary. It's very powerful. It's interesting. And just watching some great, well-recorded performances from, God, it was over 50 years ago, 1969.
And it was called, what was it called again?
It's called Summer of Soul.
Okay.
And I you'd have to look it up and see where it's showing. I really wish Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and all these guys would just buy each other out so I could just find stuff on one thing.
Because
I'm lazy.
Right. I agree. I'm not gonna. It was funny. The whole reason for streaming was to get rid of cable, and now you got to get all these streaming services, which equal the same amount of money you were spending on cable. So it's like,
yeah, that's exactly right.
So you have to wind up picking and choosing and figuring out which ones work best for you. Doug, you work in this...
JB, you do realize there's a lot of people in the world smarter than you and I, and their job is to try to figure out how to get our money.
Right. And speaking of getting money, and you know this business, I need to run a commercial spot, but here's the odd thing. And my regular listeners, eyes will start rolling when I tell this story for the umpteenth time. I try to tell it off air before we start, but I forget half the time. The reason why this show is called the Low Tech Podcast is when I go to commercial, you won't hear the commercial, nor will you hear the bumper music. So the next thing, when we go to commercial, the next thing you'll hear after a minute or so will be my voice welcoming the audience back.
Fair enough. JB, I don't know if you know this, but I've done a fair amount of work on the KQRS morning show. Not the technically most sophisticated production in the world.
Well,
so I'll wait for you to come back.
All right. Well, that's why I call it the JB's Low Tech Podcast. So, and most people, I ask people, it's probably safe to mute yourself. Then that way you don't get, I don't get in trouble because I can't even turn you down. So, all right. I'm going to go to commercial break here on the JB's Low Tech Podcast. Today's guest is Doug Sprinthal. And as I teased at the opening, as you people are figuring out, he's more than a used car salesman. And we'll be back here on the JB's Low Tech Podcast.
Well, folks, the season is finally here. What season? Baseball and softball season, of course. Are you ready? What about you players out there? Are you ready? Is your equipment ready? What about that glove you've been using? What about that uniform you've been wearing year after year? Well, I tell you what, if it needs to be repaired, bring it to JB's Glove Repair. He'll have you together in no time. That's JAYBEES Glove Repair. With over 30 plus years of experience, he'll have you ready by game time. That's JAYBEES Glove Repair.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. As many times as we've loved and We've shared love and made love. It doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough, man. It's just not enough.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the JB's Low Tech Podcast. Speaking of low tech, I forgot to turn my mic back up when I came back. that music was the great Barry White, Can't Get Enough of Your Love, as we talk about music. So I'm quite sure that's been on your playlist a time or two there, Doug.
Barry scared me. I mean, he's got too much testosterone. Just, his voice is just too macho for me. No, he's great.
All right, I want to move things along and talk about you are a youth minister.
I was going to correct you about that. So, yep. I guess in a sense I was at one time. So, Sarah and I were church musicians for a number of years at our old church, and we always would bring up young people from the congregation that were learning. You know, we went through so many drummers. We'd start when they were 12,
right?
And they were terrible. By the time they were 15, they were getting pretty good. And then by the time they were 16 or 17, they're off to college, and we had to start all over again. So that's as close to youth ministry as I really got. But it was important, and it was really good, and I enjoyed doing that. And in fact, one of the kids just graduated from Northwestern with a master's in fine arts and performance, so...
Well, you got him or her started down the road so that's kind of ministry, you know.
Well, I made this kid cry when he first started playing. We were practicing before the service, and the music director would stop, and we're just figuring out parts, and this kid kept wailing away on his drums, and I told him, hey, in between tunes, don't play. And he did it like four or five times. I finally said, Sam, we got to talk. Dragged him to the back room, and I says, if you want to take this seriously, you're welcome to do it. If you're going to screw around and act like a little kid, then get out, because we don't need you. And he started crying, and I said, that's the other thing. There's no crying in music. And the kid's got a master's now, and I teased him about that, you know, a couple years later. He goes, I had it coming. I got it. You know, so.
Well, that's cool. You have sparked an interest in many kids' life, and ministering. That's basically all it is. It's helping guide them through and helping them find something that will, you know, that they'll be interested for a long time and maybe make a career out of it. So
yeah, you never know. You really never do. But you're right, it is cool. And it was always a challenge as a musician in church, because, you know, there's a part of you that wants to put out the best product. I hate to use that word, but you understand what I mean, that you can. But then there's another part of it. It's like, okay, this is really not about your glory. This is a church. This is about community. So at some level, I think you have to have it with a little league aspect where everybody gets to play, right?
Right.
So, and you try to balance that out by letting everybody play, but really kind of, I don't want to say getting on them, but trying to get the best performance that you can out of them. That was always the challenge. And, it's fun, but it's different than putting together, you know, the best band that you can. And, you know, some of these modern churches, that's their style, because they're so, it's so big, the congregations are so enormous, that it's just a little bit different approach.
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. And during my years on the KQ Morning Show, and we'd go to commercials, and we would hear these commercials where a guy would basically do his own spot for car dealership. And then it became radio byplay between him and Tom doing the show. And it was like, who is this guy? Well, ladies and gentlemen, this guy is the person I'm talking to, Doug Sprinthal, and Doug has now also gotten into podcasting. You want to talk about your podcast and how that's going?
Well, it's all started because of people that you know. It was actually Dave Mordahl's idea a couple of years ago.
Was it?
He's like, Doug, you and I should do a podcast, because Dave, as you know, as most people know, and most of your listeners do, professional comedian, but he's also kind of a gearhead. I mean, yes, he can weld together, you know, two sticks and some duct tape and turn it into something that'll work. And, you know, he was on all these cool shows. I'm like, that would be so much fun. And I talked to Tom. I said, hey, could we put it on your network? He goes, whatever you want. You can do it and use the studio. He's been incredibly generous. Well, 2 weeks before we're going to do the first one, Dave called and he bailed. And as you know, he's got health issues and emphysema's really taken its toll on him. Apparently smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day for 30 years isn't good for you. There's some breaking medical research. And I've said this to Dave. I'm not telling stories. They're saying things that I wouldn't say to his face. So I called Tom up and I said, God, you know, I'm not a professional. I know just enough to be dangerous. I can't carry this myself. I need a sidekick. Dave bailed. Do you know anybody that would want to do it? And he goes, well, I'll do it. And I'm like, could you send me a sizzle reel? You know? So of course, I jumped at it, and it's been really fun. You know, it's called Car Selling Secrets. Initially, it was really about the car business.
Right.
But I learned after a while that there's only so much content, you know, there. So we mix it up with people that are, just have interesting stories. So some, you know, we will do have car people in, but actually the guy that's going to be on this week, you probably know. Do you know Peter Bourne?
Yes, I know.
He worked at KQ, and yep, really interesting guy. And there's kind of a faith journey there. Peter is a musician. He was the guy for old KQ fans that started the KQ janitors back in the early 90s or so. In fact, Peter, I played with Peter on July 3rd down in Red Wing, but it's another story. He and his wife, and they're also boaters, they bought this boat that had been sunk for insurance claim purposes, brought it back to life. It's up in, I can't remember the name of the marina, Watergate Marina, which is kind of at the confluence of the Minnesota and the Mississippi River. 70 feet long, and he's turning it into a floating mobile recording studio. Now, you would think, okay, this just sounds like crazy talk.
Yes.
But it's 3/4 done, and it's viable. In fact, Nick Sterling just got married on the boat at the St. Paul Yacht Club about a month ago. The cool thing that he and his wife are planning to do when it's ready is they're going to schedule weeks in the summertime up and down the Mississippi River, teaming up with Vacation Bible School in these small towns. So like La Crosse, Wisconsin, Prairie du Chien, all this sort of stuff. And they'll invite them down for a week seminar where they'll go through songwriting, and then the end product is that they'll record right in the studio. So Peter's an interesting guy. I mean, we're not friends yet. That's probably in the near future to call him a friend, but he's more than a strong acquaintance. But, you know, so many people can dream big like that. Peter's actually pulling it off. He had a connection to go see another guy floating recording studio that doesn't move. It was in London. Some guy who played guitar player in a band you might have heard of called Pink Floyd.
Yes.
So he's hanging out with David Gilmour in David's recording studio, getting ideas and stuff. And so Car Selling Secrets really is all over the place. We'll probably not talk anything about cars with Peter. We've had Angie Craig on. It's really, as you know, I think the biggest challenge of doing podcasts, other than, you know, getting the listenership and kind of reaching out to the audience, because there's so much clutter out there, it's really booking guests. I was surprised how much time I spend doing that.
Yeah, you have to, for me, I have to go through my mental Rolodex and, you know, would this person work? Would this person work? Would they come on?
Yep.
I've had people agree to come on, and then it's like, hey, okay, let's set up a time, and you never hear from them. It's like, oh, that's great.
So the thing that I run into, and you'll appreciate this because I'm sure you've seen it, is probably a third of the people that I've asked to be on mine, they've done it, but they've been super intimidated because of Tom. I'm like, he's a nice guy. He's not going to kill you. He goes, so I'm going to be in a room with Tom Bernard. Like, okay. If you do the show, try not to do that.
Right. Well, for me,
in fact, we had a friend on. She's an Episcopalian priest, and we were in the same church together when she went through all the stuff, and from a rural community in western Minnesota, a little farm town out there. And she did the show, and her brothers were so jealous. They're like, we've been listening to Tom for 35 years, and you get to meet him? How did that work out?
Well, for me, some of the people that I interviewed were intimidated because they thought I was going to, because I've interviewed some former and present Gopher coaches and whatnot, and they were afraid that I was going to do the got you moment or whatever. And it's like, I'm not going to do that. I said, it's hard enough to book people. Why would I make life even harder by playing that silly game? You know, it's just, I just want people to come on, tell their story, relax, have a good time, and for me to have
And I think if you ever you did the gotcha thing, that would be the end of the podcast episode, because the guy just hang up.
Right.
You know, it's just...
Yeah, it's just not the thing to do, so...
Yeah.
Unless that is the game you want to play and have people hang up on you or never appear or whatnot, which would make for boring... After a while, would make for boring radio.
Yeah. If you're good at it, you're on 60 Minutes or you're John Lastman doing chucker bits, the rest of the time you're just going to get hung up on.
Right. Continue telling about the car selling secrets, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so it's I really think that, and this goes back to the radio strategy that you were talking about with KQ, and we kind of stumbled on that by accident. Tom and I had been doing pre-recorded stuff, and I was writing some pretty fun ads, and you know, he liked it because they were just, you know, way better than 1-877 cars for kids. The bar is pretty low to be able to write a better commercial than that.
Right.
But when we started doing the live stuff, the marketing director at the time was a really good friend of mine, says, you know, instead of shouting we need to sell a Corolla in the next 10 or 15 minutes, 97% of the population is not in the market for a new car at any given moment. It's only 3% of the people that are. So why don't we come up with a strategy so we're not boring the other 97% of the people to death, and then when they're ready, they'll think of us. So it's really sort of a top-of-mind initiative. And the podcast is kind of the same thing, really. It's about, if you have interesting content, and I've actually learned a lot working with Tom, how to make listeners sort of lean into the conversation a little bit, then you've got something, whether it's podcasting or writing commercials. As long as you've got people that feel like there's a personal connection with whoever it is, whether it's your guest on a podcast or if they ask interesting questions or have great stories, people do lean in and they pay a lot of attention, and that's valuable in podcasting and advertising. So it took a little while for me to figure it out. One of the things that we stumbled on, this is fun, is that we always ask the guests the same first question, which is, tell us the story of your first car. And we've had so many hysterical, you know, almost everybody out there, their first car is a total, can I say piece of shit on
podcast? Yeah, you can.
You get it. Okay. Well, you get it. I mean, we started out with $500 cars, and you know, you have to kickstart them and push them downhill. Jimmy Francis, the mayor of South St. Paul, has the best all-time first story. He's deer hunting in Mankato while he's in college. Deer strapped to the top of his old Dodge Dart. The car overheats at midnight. Some old guy pulls in front of him with a Buick, starts calling him Dutchman, says, I got a radiator for that, but why don't we just swap cars? So they swap cars at the side of the road at midnight. And I said, Jimmy, you didn't tell the best part of the story. He goes, oh, I kept the deer. So that was always a good way to ice break the show. And here's an interesting thing. I will tell you the second funniest answer was Tom's daughter, Alex, who couldn't remember if her first car was the Jag or the Audi. And we're like, get out of here, you cake-eating princess.
Tom loves it when people pick on Alex, by the way, and I don't know why, but he gets there's comics that come in and pick on Alex constantly.
There's no need for a paternity test there. They really are kind of the same person.
Yes, they are. And Andy's more, Tom's son is more like his mother. Catherine. So it's a very,
yeah, I think you're right.
It's a very interesting dichotomy. So speaking of cars and speaking of people buying cars, I got touched for a new car back in April.
Okay.
And I brought it from Walzer, and it's a 2021 Toyota Venza. I'm very happy because you knew that I was happy with the 2013 Venza that I had, and I kept...
Did you write Toyota a letter? So for people that don't know what a Venza is, it's basically an all-wheel drive Camry with a sport utility style body. And they made them from 08, and I'm working from memory here, I'll screw it up. They stopped making them about 6 or 7 years ago, and then they started again. And JB, I remember when he bought the first one from us, he's like, this is the nicest car I've ever owned. This is perfect for me.
Right. And
so, anyway.
And beyond your description of it, it also has like 7 luxury car features, which is what I really like about it. You know, like the first time I drove it and parked it and like took off my seatbelt and got in the chair, pushed me back, I was like blown away by something so simple. But it's like, oh yeah, that's a luxury car feature. And I was like, for somebody with long legs like me, that's great because that, you don't.
We have that in Sarah's car, and it is really wonderful. It's very cute. You go, oh, this is nice.
Well, and I said, end this by talking about cars again, and I was talking about my car. And part of what was going on with me buying the car was the fact that you guys needed my old car because the pandemic has done such a. And it's great for the car, used car business, but it's done such a thing as the inventory's low and whatnot. So,
yeah.
And why is that happening? Why are people buying up used cars?
Let me give you the quick story. Hopefully this won't be too boring, but there is a huge microchip shortage worldwide. It's triggered by a few things. It actually started before the pandemic with some of these tariff wars that we were in with Asian countries that actually produce these. Then COVID hit. These manufacturing plants got shut down. There was a big one in Taiwan that caught on fire. And the automobile business only accounts for about 10% of global chip production. So they're in everything, smartphones, TVs, so on and so forth. I needed a new refrigerator for my boat. They're back ordered for 4 months because there's no chips. So what happened was that drove down new car inventories, but it's all supply and demand. So if there's not, new cars available in normal numbers, then late model used cars, the prices just kept going up and up and up and up. So if you were like you, or actually I did the same thing, JB, I had a 2018 Honda CRV that I just loved. It was perfect. It did everything I needed. And we started doing these commercials, Walzer Buys Cars, and I thought, from a consumer, I want to test it out and see what this is like. So I went on the website and punched in my CRV, and it's like, holy crap, I might as well buy a new one. Now, that is starting to show signs of change. So I was the used car director for Walzer for a long time, and I like that. It's a fun market to watch. I think wholesale prices peaked in about the middle of June. They're starting to come down. And this is happening in other industries, too. I heard this about, the price of lumber went up 400% earlier this year, and now it's starting to moderate a little bit. So used cars are coming down, and they'll have to. At the height of it, there was used cars that were being sold for more than they sold for when they were brand new. Those days, I think, are kind of behind us. New car inventories are starting to build again. I think we'll be back to normal really by the end of the year. Production won't be at 100%, but in Minnesota, car selling is seasonal. From end of November until the 1st of March, it really is kind of the mud season. It's pretty dry, so... things are improving. It's going to take a while to sort this out, but but these car prices, people are worried about inflation right now. A big part of the inflation in the U.S. right now is because of elevated new and used car prices. It's, you know, that's just so, there's so many dollars that flow through the automobile business that when things get out of kilter there, it shows up in inflation figures. The good news is that unlike the, you know, some people are, they're drama queens and they go, oh, this is just like 08 and it's a bubble, it's going to break. No, the 08 housing crisis was caused by lenders giving money to people that had no income to buy right. $500,000 home. This is caused by we don't have enough parts to make what people want to buy. We'll fix the we don't have enough parts part. It's not going to crash the economy. The world isn't going
to
happen.
Well, it was interesting because I kept getting emails asking me to, you know, take a look at it. It's like, no, I'm not going there. I'm not going there. So I had made an appointment for an oil change. And I'm sitting there, and then somebody comes down, and I thought it was the person telling me about what they found in my car. And it's like, okay, this is what we could do for you for your car. It's like, oh, what is going on here? And I wasn't offended by it. I was just kind of surprised. And it was,
yeah, no, they got aggressive, and in a nice way. So
right.
For a dealer, your best source of used car inventory are new car trades. But when your new car right. trade figures go way, way down, you have to find other sources to buy them. We pulled people out of leases early. We did all kinds of stuff. And it really was just starting conversations like that. And at Toyota, they do a really good job of, it's called working the service aisle, which that's kind of an insider term, but it's like, you know, they're probably not thinking about buying a car, but they might be surprised what their car is actually worth, and then maybe they'll make the next step. So basically, you fell for it.
Right.
I'm kidding.
Well, yeah, I did fall for it. Well, you know, I didn't instantly go, oh, yeah. I was like, yeah. And then Greg Davis floats by, and he goes, give them $1,600 above that. And it's like, what is going on here? And then, so they go crunch the number, and Keela's pulled up a car for me to test drive. And I'm test driving, and it's like, and I'm still like, no, I'm not going to do this. You know, I've, and
if you got in front of Keela Smith, you were done.
And
he's
so,
a terrific salesman, and people always ask me, you know, what's different about those guys
right.
like Keela and Kevin Don, and we've got a series of them in different stores. And the difference, most people that are in sales, when they sell something and the customer says, okay, I'll take it, we're kind of pleasantly surprised. People like Keela are shocked when people say no. It's like, what? Of course you like the car, you like me, let's. It's funny. So anyway, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's JB. Fine. But so it got down to, they showed me how much I would be paying. Right now I'm leasing. It's a lease, but, you know, it was uh-huh. like 36 months of this or 33. I still had 33 payments of the old car. It was like,
yeah.
And there was only like an $85 difference. And I was like, oh, for $85 more and three more payments, I can be driving. And I was like, you probably don't, it's like, you probably don't have the color I want. And he's like, Keela goes, what color? And I said, maroon. And he turns around, he goes, you mean that color? There was a car in the lobby, the color I wanted, and I just said, all right, I'll do it. So, yeah, and it was. And here's the very weird thing is, so on my test drive, the dealership is close to where my son lives in Richfield. So
yeah.
I'm literally calling him, and he's not answering the phone. And I go to the door, and I'm ringing the doorbell, and because I see his car, and so because I wanted him to be in the test drive, and he didn't. He claims he was cleaning, but I think he was sleeping. And so I go back, I get the car. They had me take my old car home, completely clean it out, as far as get everything out of it, and then bring it back, and we made the swap and whatnot. And then I finally go back to his place, and I finally get him on the phone, and I said, can you come out? And so he comes out, he sits in the car, and he goes, what's so important? What's the big news? And it's like, what do you mean, what's the big news? Did you not notice the color of the car? He goes, your car was always
can you smell?
He goes, your car's always been this color. It's like, no, my car, and probably should have him check for colorblindness, but I said, no.
Isn't your son a graphic artist?
Yes.
Yeah, if he's colorblind, he might think of another profession.
Yeah, I know. And I go, no, this is a new car. Did you not notice the difference in the color? And he goes, oh, I thought your car was always this color. It's like, I wanted to go, get out. But no, your team did a great job. The other anecdote I heard about the used car sales going crazy during the pandemic was you couldn't rent a car because the rental car business had gone through the roof because people couldn't fly. So they were driving all over the place.
To make it worse, they were, last year, I think Hertz went bankrupt, and to just kind of keep afloat, they sold off all their inventory.
Yeah.
And a lot of the other car manufacturers could, and they couldn't replenish it because they're not building cars at the factory. But yeah, it's crazy.
So yeah,
I do have a rental car insider tip, however.
So,
woman at work is going down to Houston to see her family for a week, and rental cars down there, she says, it's around $1,000 for a week. Wow. So somebody told me about this, and I pulled it up on their website, and I punched in 6-day rental. You can rent a pickup truck at U-Haul in Houston, Texas for $99 a week and 15 cents a mile.
Well,
hey, why not? You know, to save $900, I don't care if it says U-Haul on the side. Not going to offend me.
No, and that's interesting because, like I said, that between that and like Uber overpricing itself and all those things, people, I had heard people were going to the mobile homes and then buying up used car inventory because it was just a cheaper way than just then dealing with the car rental business. So,
yep.
Well, Doug, I really appreciate your time this morning and the stories and the anecdotes and whatnot. It's been a good time.
Yeah, I thank you for having me on. It was wonderful. This is the best Saturday morning I've spent in a long time. My wife, who is, I won't say how old she is, but she still sleeps like she's a 14-year-old teenager. So she'll be getting up in the next hour.
Right.
And I've always got up at 6 in the morning and usually just read the internet and drink coffee. But so this was really fun. It was a pleasure to reconnect with you, and maybe we can do it again, or you can be on mine sometime. That'd be fun.
Well, yeah, I have to work it out. My job is not as flexible as my old job was, as far as like coming and going.
Oh, just calling sick. Nobody will notice.
Yeah, but they'll be listening to this, Doug, so thanks a lot. No.
Oh, that's right. Never mind. Sorry. I was kidding. Never trust to use car salesman. JD, it was great. Have a lovely weekend, and we'll talk soon.
All right, Doug, thanks a lot. Take care.
JB is my name, and f***ing up motherfuckers is my game.
Right on. Negro, black, African American.
Black.
Django.
J.B.
Damn, Dolomite.
Great God in heaven, you know.
J.B.
Our great Negro sex machine.